From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an uneasy deal on Ukraine, Obamacare enrollment over 8 million, South Korean ferry disaster, and it's 1 year after the Boston bombing. In Korea, grief on the shore and a ferry packed with young down at sea. In Moscow, Vladimir Putin speaks of new Russia, but denies his troops are in Ukraine.
They claim that Russian units are operating there. This is all nonsense. There are no Russian units in the eastern Ukraine.
And the Boston Marathon bombing remembered the dead and the 260 wounded. Survivor and amputee Adrian Haslett-Davis spoke for them.
The city has stood by us, supported us, and helped us heal. Together, we held each other in the face of terror. We grieved in the face of tremendous loss. And we grew in the face of adversity.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is Ukraine defused? Is Obamacare working? Are you still thinking about that don't tread on me cattle rancher in Nevada? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington, David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, author of Blood Money and Body of Lies. David Ignatius, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you. And from New York, Diane Brady is with us, editor and content chief at Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst extraordinaire Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Diane, and David.
David, what is our situation now with Ukraine? A deal yesterday, but all those, pro-Russia resistors holding on to government buildings in eastern Ukraine, they don't seem to be budging, so where are we?
Well, I think we're waiting and watching to see whether the de-escalation that was the premise of the deal reached in Geneva yesterday after 7 hours of talk, which the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov described as a compromise of sorts. Waiting to see whether that deal is really going to work on the ground. Today, we saw in eastern Ukraine a group calling itself the Donetsk People's Republic, a name that just sort of leaps out of the past,
yeah,
said it wouldn't lay down its weapons as called for in this Geneva agreement to the existing interim government in Kiev, but to what it sees as a more legitimate successor government that would be elected in May 25 elections. That said, it's going to take a while for things to stabilize if they do. The fact that the Russians were willing to sit down with a Ukrainian government they had rejected and refused to talk to previously in this extraordinary seven-hour meeting, I think, is a sign of a movement back from the brink, whether it's 2 steps or 2 feet, I couldn't say.
But you really got to wonder about the deep bones of what's going on here. I mean, here's John Kerry coming out of that meeting yesterday in Geneva saying, hey, we've got an agreement.
We agreed today that all illegal armed groups must be disarmed, that all illegally seized buildings must be returned to their legitimate owners, and all illegally occupied streets, squares, and other public places in Ukrainian cities and towns must be vacated.
Of course, they're not vacated. They're saying, hey, new government in Kiev, you get out of there. Maybe we'll get out of here. Earlier in the week, the crackle of potential war. People talking about 1914 and the beginning of World War I. This was President Obama talking with CBS News Major Garrett on Ukraine and Russia saying we don't need a war.
We make decisions very deliberately based on what's required for our security and for the security of our allies. The Russians understand that. They're not interested in any kind of military confrontation with us, understanding that our conventional forces are significantly superior to the Russians. We don't need a war.
The president tweaking the Russians there. But David, what is the sort of, what are the deep bones underneath this? President Putin has that kind of, you know, Cheshire cat smile sometimes, like, we want Ukraine more than you want to keep us out of it, and sooner or later it's going to be ours, look, when he when his face comes on the screen.
I think you put it just right, Tom. I think that that Putin understands that Ukraine means more to Russia, and Russia is willing to take greater risks, including use of military force, to get its way in Ukraine than it means to the United States or to Europe as a whole. President Obama, interestingly, in his brief press conference yesterday, made clear that the U.S. does not believe there's a military solution in Ukraine, that it would not be appropriate. Well, that's at a time when you have at least 40,000 Russian troops just across the border in western Russia. And after Putin has said that he has authority from the Russian parliament to use military force in Ukraine if he chooses. So there's a clear demonstration of the asymmetry, the imbalance, if you will, between the stakes that Russia has here and the stakes that the U.S. and Europe do. And in that kind of situation, I think it's unrealistic to expect that you're going to be able to radically tip the balance in the U.S. and European favor. The issues for Obama have been longer-term costs for Putin of this kind of adventurism, longer-term ways to make Europe less dependent on Russian energy, and I think holding out a promise for the interim government in Kiev of real European and U.S. support as they try to build a more stable country.
Jack, Diane, I want to come to you on this. Jack, you first. What do you see unfolding here? He's, you know, reasonable tone from Putin, but he's got those 40,000 troops right across the border. And despite his denials, it looks like Crimea, where there were, turns out there, yes, there were Russian troops inside. You know, does he stop? Is the threat of sanctions serious enough? Can the U.S. and Europe really pull those together in any case?
Or can he gamble that he can separate the U.S. and Europe on that issue? Break up the alliance on it. Who knows? They talk about asymmetry. David sets it well, what Russia's national interest versus Obama's feeling about world order. Those are asymmetrical. But so perhaps might be the interest of the Europeans in their economy vis-a-vis the United States. And he may well calculate that he can work on that seam right there. You know, he's in a situation where it sounds like he is manufacturing his own reality. I mean, weeks ago, Angela Merkel said that about him. He's in a different world. Well, so apparently is everybody else in Russia. He's at 80% approval. His media just keeps repeating the Russian version of reality, which departs more or less 180 degrees from the facts. So he's not constrained by it. He can make up the realities that he wants to manipulate, to deny, to create a crisis over. It is an extraordinary situation.
But I mean, who's making up? I mean, his arms industry is there in eastern Ukraine. That's a reality, Jack. His history is there. A lot of Russian history there. A lot of Russians are there.
Absolutely. But his claims about, you know, the persecution being felt by Russian speakers, the anti-Semitism that was involved in the Kiev and the Maidan protests, the fascism and so on, all of that
alleged.
Seems to be, alleged. Yes, all of that seems to be piped. And the propaganda apparatus, as you read about it, is just immense. And Russians are watching it and saying, that's a terrible situation there. We've got to do something about it.
Of course, this week news of notices in Donetsk saying Jews register, talk about anti-Semitism. This is where the sort of pro-Russian forces have gained dominance. Diane Brady, there was a moment midweek where it looked like this could be going towards something really hairy, and I wonder about a ripple-on effect for the economy if this isn't sort of reined in and brought into diplomatic channels, Diane.
Well, I think the economy is what gives people hope that it will be reined in. I don't know if you recall that Angela Merkel's actually went to a trade show not too long ago where one of the companies of the people that allegedly was being sanctioned, you know, was right there. And so they clearly have no interest in Europe in raising this to the point where it will, in fact, really hurt the economies. And I think the economy is one reason why the people love what Putin's doing in Russia. There's no better distraction than a strong leader. But he's shown no interest in wanting to take this further than where it is, which is great for his polls, you know, certainly get back part of the Ukraine. But he hasn't shown any interest in trying to raise this to the point where it's a military conflict.
David, we see what's on the line for Russia, for Putin here, as he frames it. What is on the line for the United States, for President Obama?
Well, I think for President Obama, the threat posed by Putin's aggressive actions, initially in Crimea, then fomenting disorder in eastern Ukraine, in both cases using, it appears, Russian special operations and intelligence forces, that the threat is to what Obama likes to call the international rules-based order. Obama is a lawyer. He's a, you know, he's a disciplined, analytical person, and I think he wants to feel that he's creating, reinforcing orderly means for resolving disputes, and that's what's been threatened.
And you write that
his actions in Russia.
He's probably willing to have a Ukraine that faces both ways. That is a little bit Russia's, a little bit the West's.
I think that Obama and indeed most European leaders have been ready to accept this Finlandized, to use the old Cold War term, a version of Ukraine, a country that looks east and west at the same time, that conceivably, maybe someday, decades from now, might join the European Union, but would probably never be a NATO member. Obama has been very, very clear that he is not prepared to provide arms to the Ukrainian government, despite their fervent requests for arms, because he just doesn't want to turn this into a proxy war. Just one more thing I'd add. Traveling in Europe last week, I was struck by how little Europeans want to add another problem country to an already messy European Union. They're having trouble holding that union together as it is.
Maybe a Finlandized Ukraine, but fine by them as well. We're up against a break here. Stand by, David Ignatius. Great to have you here from the Washington Post. Diane Brady from Bloomberg Business Week. Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, ferry tragedy, Obamacare at 8 million, Ukraine tension, confusion, a marathon bombing anniversary, and world economic jitters. Jack Beatty's here, Diane Brady from Bloomberg Businessweek, David Ignatius from The Washington Post. We've got a lot more news beyond Ukraine, but I have to pause just for a moment. This remarkable scene as Vladimir Putin held his press event yesterday in Moscow, and there's a video feed with NSA leaker Edward Snowden asking the Russian president about domestic mass surveillance in Russia. Here's that exchange interpreted here by RT.
Does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals?
Mr. Snowden, you are a former agent, a spy. I used to be working for an intelligence service. We are going to talk one professional language. First of all, our intelligence efforts are strictly regulated by our law, and you have to get a court permission to stalk a particular person. We don't have a mass system of such interception, and according to our law, with our law, it cannot exist.
Yeah, no, not here, not in Russia. Jack Beatty, what the heck? I mean, we have Pulitzer Prizes this week. Pulitzer Prizes based on the leaking of Edward Snowden, and a lot of celebration on the transparency and exposure side in many quarters. And then here he comes on the big video screen, and I mean, he looks for all the world like some kind of stooge, patsy. I mean, am I wrong? What? Like the biggest softball question you could lob up. And of course, Vladimir Putin has a lot of fun, you know, smacking it right back kind of in Washington's face.
Yes, and an absurd answer that even in Russia, when I've read, people are howling over that one, or at least the intelligentsia is howling.
Surveillance because, here?
Yeah.
The former Soviet Union by former KGB guy?
No way.
I mean, look, we've got our own. Fair enough, but.
Yeah, I mean. Go ahead. Excuse me, Diane.
No, I was going to say even the rule of law. I mean, that's what's funny. I mean, this is a man who's been throwing girl bands in jail just for singing anti-Putin songs. So I think on the streets there's probably a good chuckle over this as well.
David Ignatius, what happens to Snowden's reputation globally in the aftermath of that 30 seconds of airtime?
Well, this can't help Snowden's standing. It does expose the bizarre reality that he is living under the protection of what is still essentially a police state, and talking about the need for civil liberty, something that a lot of Americans obviously agree with from this bizarre perch. And it, you know, it was a moment in which he just looked, I think, to the world like someone who was being used by a very repressive government.
Strange moment indeed. I mean, who knows how it was edited? And there's been plenty of plaudits this week with the Pulitzers and everything else, but that was bizarre. I want to turn to Washington and Obamacare. There was so much trouble with the Obama website, the Obamacare website last fall, and then the big drama over whether or not they'd make their numbers. And then this week, news that they hit more than their numbers. At least that's what we're hearing from the White House. And President Obama going right after Republicans in that context for continued criticism of the law.
The Republican position on this law is still stuck in the same place that it has always been. They still can't bring themselves to admit that the Affordable Care Act is working. They said nobody would sign up. They were wrong about that. They said it would be unaffordable for the country. They were wrong about that.
Well, Diane, is the president right to be crowing this week, or is it still a we shall see situation?
Well, there's certainly hiccups, but one thing I think that people have taken note of is how many young people have been signing up. Because one of the fears anytime, you know, with this is that you get a lot of sick people pouring into any healthcare system. And I think that's really shown how it's resonated just across the nation. So clearly, you know, there are issues, but he is right to say that, you know, net-net, people are viewing this as a success and something that essentially is putting people in the right direction. I think my bias is showing here as a Canadian, but, you know, I don't know. I'm not that familiar with the 202 area code. They seem to crow every day about something. But,
oh boy.
But here's something I think that they can hold up as being at least not the disaster that Republicans have portrayed it to be.
Early enough or late enough in the game to say that, Jack? Do we know yet? The 8 million number was certainly something I'm sure even the Obama people were very happy to see come over the transom.
Yeah, you know, the House GOP whip, Kevin McCarthy, greeted that number with skepticism. Among other questions, he asked some good ones. He said, how many of the 8 million who have signed up have paid up, and how many this month, last month? Well, the answer may not please him. I mean, one big insurance company reported last week that 80% of its new enrollees had paid premiums for that month. Suppose that's true generally. Does that mean Republicans will accept that as a threshold of success? It's of course, much more likely that they're going to shift their attack to the future, as McCarthy did when he said, how many will pay their premiums next month and the month after that? It's as if they're shifting to follow the Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld's formulation, shifting from attacking Obamacare's known unknowns to the misty ground of Obamacare's unknown unknowns. I mean, we don't know what the future will bear. But it is significant, I think, that in just the last month, they shift, or in a series of questions, he shifts from things that are provable to things that we can't know. Does that mean the Republicans have a weaker argument? No, I think Diane may overstate the case about public acceptance. There is some slight movement in the polls toward Obamacare, but still on net negative. On the other hand, this is good news, and more of it, the Obama people say, is going to follow.
David Ignatius, this all wrapped up, of course, with budgets. What's it going to cost? We're hearing in the news today this projection of a $6 trillion budget, a billion more than the Obama people are saying off of their projections for what's coming in the future. On Obamacare, on the bigger budget conversation, who's pushing the needle this week, David?
Well, the budget issues have receded a good deal in Washington from where they were 6 months ago. I think the key question about Obamacare is the one that's still hardest to answer, which is it in fact going to help bend the cost curve of health care delivery in the United States down so that it takes up less of our GDP, so that it's affordable, so that, yes, there's broader health care for everyone, but it's less expensive to provide. It's not going to bankrupt the country. We don't know the answer yet. There's some positive signs, but people I talk to say, hold on, you've got to wait and see. I think politically, Obama is trying now to turn the corner. Public doesn't like it when Republicans just obstruct, when they just try to block bloc government or seen as blocking government. The polls are pretty clear on that. And if Obama can say they're doing it again on health care, they just won't give it up. This is a settled issue, but they keep trying to obstruct. I think he hopes he can change the political conversation in his favor.
Diane, can we pull back a little bit just for a minute here and look at the bigger economic picture? This is clearly going to feed into it. If those costs don't come down, if the budget's in trouble, and more immediately, I mean, this week, you know, on the one hand, we're hearing about, is there a housing bubble? On the other hand, here's a report from a colleague of yours, Bloomberg's Michael McKee. This is on the Bloomberg Television's In the Loop, saying housing starts, building permits down. Here's that report.
Housing starts are up, but not as much as analysts had thought. We get a 2.8% increase. The forecast was for a 7% increase. We still are higher on the month, 946,000 at an annual rate. So we're continuing to improve. This is the best result since December.
I said down. I should say up far lower than far less than expectations. I mean, we've seen in the last couple of weeks a lot of gyration in the stock market, jitters there, headlines talking about world growth engines faltering in China, in Brazil. I don't know what's going on with the housing market here at home. What's the economic backdrop here, Diane?
Well, I think the housing market, let's start with that. If anything, it's probably good news that it's not, you know, 7% plus, because one of the fears people have right now is another bubble. Mm-hmm. You know, you make something cheap, people buy a lot of it. Money is cheap right now, and that got us into trouble in the first place. So generally, people think the economy is moving in the right direction, but then there are issues. Obviously, you look at jobs. One of the issues is 30% of the unemployed now are long-term unemployed. How do you get those people back to work? Wage growth. And I think those are all issues that certainly weigh on people. But by and large, the economy, certainly in the U.S., is moving in the right direction. There's concern about China. But in China, you know, slow growth means 7%, not 7.5 or more. So there are issues, but it's still, you know, it's a fast-growing economy. It's an economy that increasingly is consuming more of our goods.
David, what about China? I mean, Brazil had some weak numbers out this week as well. China and Brazil have been engines when the U.S. And others were stalling out. They've got some big lending and banking issues in China. What about what they're dealing with and their challenge in, what is it, sort of cooling things without colding things?
Yes, deflating the balloon without popping it. People talk about a soft landing. That's what the Chinese economic managers would like to achieve. And it's very tricky. I just recently was in Shanghai and was hearing reports from people who follow financial markets in China carefully about significant liquidity issues, sharp spikes in overnight lending rates, which is always a sign that people are just nervous about holding assets, even very short term. The Chinese authorities know that they have been making credit too easy in China in ways that have fueled a lot of bad uncollectible loans, especially by local authorities, that have also encouraged corruption you see in many regions of China. And the new president, Xi Jinping, seems very serious about stopping that. And the question is, can he stop it without a rather severe contraction? If he cuts back on lending, cuts back on people's access to cash to fuel these dubious ventures, is he going to really shake the Chinese economy? Chinese have been amazingly successful in macroeconomic management, and so there's a division among people that I read and talk to about whether they can pull it off this time.
Some real doomsayers out there on the market, Diane. Are you going to say that's healthy too, because it went up so fast, so straight?
Well, I mean, let's look at where the market is. It's been incredible. You know, that's one reason why Yahoo, you know, fired somebody this week and he got a $58 million severance package. It was all because his stock package had gone up 3.5 times. So, you know,
there's been a little bit of a
pullback there. But by and large, we're still seeing, you know, dizzying heights to some people in terms of the markets. And will we see some pullback here and there? Yes, probably. You know, gold certainly is moving up. But I think by and large, you cannot sit and be pessimistic at this point about the markets, because even where we are at this point this week, after a wild week, not so bad.
Let me get a call right here from Melissa. Melissa, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Great.
I'm calling because my husband and I are both professionals. We're both in our 40s. We make reasonably good incomes, and yet we are having a hard time affording a house. We have friends who have children who are getting out of college, who are having a hard time finding jobs that are going to be able to pay for apartments in this area. How does that signify that the economy is moving in a good direction?
Diane, what about it? The number of people out there for whom their personal experience says something's not adding up.
I think certainly the housing crisis has been a real issue in terms of affordability. You look at first-time homebuyers, they're priced out of a lot of markets, and that's a real problem. In terms of job growth, you know, I think the issue really is it's very much city-by-city specific. You look at cities like New Orleans, Houston, very low unemployment rates. I don't know exactly what it is in Boston, but it's very much about the skills gap and where are the jobs. The jobs are often in areas that are not correlated to what the skills people have.
But Melissa's a professional in a city that uses a lot of them. Of course, it's a high-income
city. Yeah. So I think that's an issue going forward. But the reality is that for the top tier of Americans, they're still doing very well. They still have relatively low taxes. And, you know, they still, in essence, are getting those jobs. In fact, are getting more of those jobs. The issue, by and large, has been on that lower tier in terms of very little wage growth. And I think that when you're in a market like Boston or New York, you feel the pinch because, frankly, you're surrounded by a lot of wealthy people who can afford to buy a lot of house in those markets.
Well, some days that top tier can appear kind of small if you're two professionals in a house and you
can't
swing it.
Yeah, it's true. Very true.
Boston in the news nationally, globally this week. The anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. Vice President Joe Biden was in town speaking very warmly to the city.
So much has been taken from you, but you never, never have given up. Not even those tough days when you're lying in that hospital bed, I remember, and looking and staring at the ceiling and saying, God, I don't know how I can do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And wondering, how much more can you take? But you've mustered the courage, you got up and you kept going. And you brought an awful lot of other people with you as you walked on that prosthetic leg. You're undeterred. And you're unyielding.
Three deaths on that day, the bombing day a year ago, 260 wounded. There were plenty of limbs lost that day. And Biden, though, coming to his conclusion with a very kind of stern sound here. Americans never yielding to fear, he said.
We will never yield. We will never cower. America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
We own the finish line, Jack. Boston born and bred. It's been a lot of talk and remembrance this week. A lot of respect for those who paid a heavy price. Where do you end this week thinking about the events of a year ago and their reverberations?
Well, you know, in a government in which accountability still mattered, Vice President Biden would have come to Boston and said what his administration was doing to correct the failures of the FBI that surround that bombing. I mean, I say surround, because months before the bombing, not only did the FBI fail to tell the Boston police about their investigation of Tsarnaev, they kept that a secret even during the days of the manhunt. And even today, a year later, the FBI says that knowing what it knows now, it would not have revisited that investigation. Has President Obama called for a shakeup of the FBI? Does the agent who told investigators, and I quote, he did not know why he did not ask Tsarnaev about his plans to travel to Russia, does this incurious G-man still hold his job? You know, instead of giving an accounting, as you say, Biden gave a triumphalist pep talk. It's like after 9/11, politicians in collusion sometimes with a rah-rah media, they dissolve their responsibility in piety, prating about Boston strong, but not publicly correcting the failures that led to Boston let down, Boston betrayed. You know, it reminds me of the Jack Nicholson Colonel and A Few Good Men. It's as if our leaders think about us, you can't handle the truth.
David Ignatius, are we missing something on the truth of this bombing a year later?
Well, I have two thoughts. First, I think it really was a moving anniversary for
it
all
was.
Americans. To me, the central theme was resilience, in contrast to the way that America was knocked off balance by 9/11, took years really to recover its sense of balance. In Boston, with the Boston Marathon bombings, there was right away a kind of steady center. Jack brings up something that I would say is the paradox.
Hold the thought on that, David. We'll come to it. Boston resilient at this moment. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news resonating this week, Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and a lot of heavily armed supporters faced off with the federal government, Bundy saying he had the right to graze his cattle on federal land without paying. On Saturday, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management returned approximately 400 head of cattle it had seized from Bundy. Here's Bundy.
They wanted to show the American people and the world that they had unlimited power, and they, you know, they had taken over state sovereignty, our Nevada laws, our public lands.
Well, an extraordinary T-Rex skeleton out of Montana arrived in Washington for display at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Here's Museum Director Kirk Johnson.
It ranks as one of the top five skeletons of Tyrannosaurus Rex ever discovered. And it's really with great pleasure that we bring it here to the Rotunda and the National Museum of Natural History.
And Nobel Prize-winning literary giant out of Latin America, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, died yesterday at 87. The Colombian author of 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera was the master of magical realism. Here from his 1982 Nobel acceptance speech.
We, the inventors of tales, will believe anything, feel entitled to believe that it is not yet too late to engage in the creation of a new and sweeping utopia of life.
Ready to think and imagine big. We're looking at a week in the news, ferry tragedy, Obamacare at 8 million, Ukraine tension, confusion, a marathon bombing anniversary, and economic jitters in some quarters. David Ignatius is with us, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Diane Brady, editor, content chief for Bloomberg Businessweek. Jack Beatty's here. And David Ignatius, I don't want to miss the rest of your thought there on the marathon bombing, the anniversary, what we've learned.
Just briefly to respond to something that Jack said, if the FBI investigation of the Sarnaevs was incompetent, there's no excuse for that. But I do think his comment points up the paradox that faces us as citizens and certainly faces law enforcement intelligence. We want less intrusive law enforcement. New York just pulled back a big aggressive program to look at the Muslim community in New York, and a lot of people said, good, that's the... But when there are mistakes, when people get through this, you know, looser net, less intrusive net, we get angry and we say, why weren't the local police there to protect us? And I think that's the kind of the tightrope that the country is on. And Jack's comment interested me and reminded me of that issue that just is going to continue.
I mean, can't we be cognizant of that tension and at the same time, in the appropriate ground between a police state and incompetence, judge performance?
Well, that's exactly right. Finding that ground where we are a free society and also a secure society is a continuing challenge. I think it's a fascinating one because you keep overcorrecting on one side or another. But we should see it as that. We should see it as the perfect law enforcement that would always snag the culprit. It might be part of a state in which we would not want to live.
We go to Dorman in Cleveland, Ohio. Dorman, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Norman with an N.
Oh, thank you, Norman.
And thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. What I read in the paper yesterday that either the Ukrainians or the Russians in eastern Ukraine were asking Jews to register. And it just brings to mind when the Nazis rounded up something like 10,000 Jews in the Ukraine and in a ravine and massacred them. So who is it that's behind this call for the roundup or for the registration of Jews? Is that the Ukrainians or the Russians?
Let me take that to David Ignatius. David, this was not entirely clear in the end to me whether this was real or whether this was some kind of... Almost a weird performance art, but it seemed to be tied to the pro-Russian groups in eastern Ukraine. But please speak to Norman's question.
It's a good and disturbing question, and my answer is we don't know yet. Secretary Kerry, in his press conference in Geneva last night, referred specifically and at some length to this effort to register Jews in Ukraine, whoever was doing it, and he was not clear about that. So he at least takes the reports seriously. The Russians have made a central part of their propaganda since this crisis began their allegation that the Ukrainian rebels, now the interim government, is anti-Semitic, and that's been denied repeatedly. But it's a theme that's been woven through this story for the last couple of months.
But in my readings, this pamphlet or posting, whatever it was pinned much more on the opponents of the regime, the government in Kiev.
Yes, but it's also true that the Russians have asserted that there is a conservative and anti-Semitic aspect to protest.
They've asserted so many things. I mean, there's been a kind of a black for white, night for day portrayal sometimes, hasn't there been?
Yes, it's been a propaganda campaign that's sometimes been. I'm just noting that this report follows a sort of consistent a din of propaganda from Moscow on the theme.
Martha, Texas. Joe's calling. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say, this is if we just look back at history, the czars, when they got in trouble with the people economically, pulled out the Jews as to blame. All of the Eastern Europeans would go after the Jews, the pogroms. This whole thing with Putin, he cannot lose. He's got to go and take these lands. The whole negotiation thing is a scam. And what I'd like you to do is to make an international show, go to Ukraine, go to Israel, go to Russia, and get those people on the ground, the intellectuals, or the people who really know what Russians are about. Because this is a group, again, that comes from a Mongol attacker's and conqueror's frame of mind. For 1,000 years, they've been blaming the Jews every time the czar and now this guy got in trouble.
Joe, I see the history. We want to be careful of throwing stereotypes around anybody here. We had Simon Schama on talking about talk about going around the world, talking about anti-Semitism and Jewish history all over continents just yesterday. Check it out. Diane, I hear you there.
Yeah, no, I think it's not unique to Russia. In fact, it's been one of the disturbing elements of the economic crisis is when you see nationalist fervor sort of come to a high. Who are anti-Jewish, anti-immigrant, anti-them. There's always an us and them. And Jews, sadly, make an easy target in certain parts of the world, and I don't think it's unique to Russia.
A very real intended target, sadly, in the last weekend, outside of Kansas City. On Sunday, we had there that 73-year-old Fraser Glenn Cross arrested in Overland Park, Kansas, after that shooting spree at a Jewish community center's three dead there, Christians, it turned out. As he was being arrested, his cries of Heil Hitler were caught on tape. Here's ABC reporter Steve Osusami.
Our ABC station in Kansas City was recording while he was screaming anti-Semitic insults during his arrest.
Heil Hitler!
Boy, Jack Beatty, that sounds almost like a send-up, but it wasn't. There was a real gun and real blood on the streets outside Kansas City.
Yes, and another person with a long history of run-ins with the law, been in jail, was under watch by, assumedly, by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but was he under watch by the government? You know, in 2009, the Homeland Security Department came out with a study saying, look, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, there's a lot of racism out there, and the election of President Obama may bring it to a boil. We note the growth in the number of these groups and so on. And immediately, Republicans said, you've got to take that off your website. That's insulting. We can't have it. Well, what are the facts about that? And, I get the stuff from the Southern, I get information from the Southern Poverty Law Center. They say that the number of these groups has actually been going down, which is a good story. On the other hand, we read about the connection, and it's only on the margins, but nevertheless, between discontented veterans who know a thing or two about guns and some of these groups, not necessarily neo-Nazi, but the Klan as a kind of, more acceptable ground. Who knows what's going on, but it is a little disturbing when that report had to be just suppressed.
Well, I mean, how much watching do you want, Jack? You want everybody watched in Boston? You want everybody watched in Kansas City? Or, I mean, how far do you really want that to go? You don't want these groups. It's not pretty, but there's the freedom question.
There is, but you know, I do think we have a, well, let's put it this way, experience should be some guide. A suspicionless, you know, investigations a la the NSA, no, but where there's ground for, you know, concern, it seems to me that people, that a certain amount of vigilance by the people paid to protect us is warranted.
Let's go to Kevin in Hartford, Connecticut. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I just want to talk about the Clive and Bundy situation and how it totally relates to our country, you know, moving and leaning towards the police state. And, you know, if people in this country can take that as an example and stand up against the government when they overstep their boundaries, you know, this country might end up being a better place and a place that George Washington, you know, would be proud of.
Kevin, let me ask you about that, though. I know that's the way that Clive Bundy framed it. We heard that. We just played it on the show here. But he and his family reportedly owed $1 million for their grazing rights on that federal land. You know, if you owed $1 million for renting us, I don't know, a shop in a strip mall, you'd be up against it. Why shouldn't he pay, Kevin?
Show me the paperwork that says that he owes $1 million. There's been acts enacted for I don't know how many years that the ranchers, it's called open free ranging, and they're allowed to, their cattle are free ranging cattle, and they can go on federal lands and come back to their private property anytime they choose. I've been in national parks and seen cows.
Well, yeah, but still, I mean, there is a deal if you want to use this land. Diane, what do you know?
Well, it's actually reminiscent to me of the actor Wesley Snipes and the principled stand he took against paying taxes, saying there was nothing saying that he had to pay taxes. Well, U.S. law enforcement and the government would suggest otherwise, and he served jail time. There are social contracts here, and I think that one of the things that's interesting is the U.S. does value being an open society, and I want to go back to something David said, which is resilience. And I think that one of the things that we do have to step up is our response to economic crises, our response to political crises, and certainly our response to terrorism. And I think that, you know, in essence, that's where I think a lot of the energy has to be put. It's very, very hard to know every domestic terrorist. It's very, very hard, I think, to know, you know, when you're going to have the next bomb, or what you need to have is a system in place to respond to it quickly.
I mean, David Ignatius, it seems that the rule of law needs some clear place here. There were a lot of heavily armed folks rallying around Clive Bundy. Now, our caller is sympathetic to him, but I think you've got a case of the law being the law here as it stands. I know there's the Sagebrush Rebellion, the people who wish it wasn't federal land, but right now it is, and I think his cattle have been on it without paying.
I just don't know the details of these issues of grazing rights that affect the Clive Bundy case. What I do know is that the condition of living in a civilized country is that law enforcement, in the end, has a monopoly of force, that it's able to maintain order, that if laws are broken, people are held accountable. And the idea that, you know, some people should have special rights or exemptions from that is unacceptable. Having said that, I just don't know the details about the particulars of the Bundy case.
Jack?
Kevin mentioned, what would George Washington say? Well, George Washington sent federal troops to crush the Whiskey Rebellion. What was the reason? They weren't paying their taxes.
That one, at least for now, the Bureau of Land Management stepping down, but they say they're going to continue to pursue legal action there. There was a rally in a hurry. Mike Bloomberg, the man for whom your news service is named, Diane, putting out $50 million this week to push for more gun control.
All for it.
our Canadian guest says all for it.
No, listen, Canadians actually can be divided on some issues, rarely, of course. But I think that this is very much about creating a lobby to counteract another lobby. There has been efforts for quite some time from Bloomberg and others about, you know, certainly what do we do about guns and in the wake of Newtown. I think this is an effort to actually put pressure on Washington, to put pressure on politicians, and to try to mobilize the kind of political will and resources that the NRA has had for generations.
We're going to talk more about that on Monday. But, Jack Beatty, I wonder what you see coming. Bloomberg explicitly saying we're going to go after politicians of either party. They'll be in trouble with us, just as the NRA goes after politicians of either party. But in this case, if they don't support some more registration or background checks at gun ownership.
Yes, and they did some of that last year. They spent some millions against Mark Pryor, the Democratic incumbent in Arkansas, and Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. So they're doing that, and the Democrats come back and say, wait a minute, if you come after us, you know, all but I think five Democrats, maybe it was six, but I believe it was about five Democrats voted for the Toomey Mansion gun control bill. All but five. Whereas on the Republican side, I think 40 odd of them voted against it. I mean, and the Democrats would say, do you want the Senate to go over to these people who simply will not vote for anything, or do you want to take your chances with us? So I think that it's going to remain controversial. And Bloomberg says, I don't care. Is up. No, but there's got to be some calculus of pragmatism there, too. And, you know, it's interesting. Mark Pryor in Arkansas actually used Bloomberg's attacks to advantage himself. He said, I'm not going to be pushed around by a New York mayor who talks about, you know, ending Big Gulp.
As in soda. More seriously, maybe, David Ignatius, we just got a minute here, but the third of four, this drumbeat of UN warnings that we're in trouble on climate, need to act fast, the one this week saying we've got about 15 years to take dramatic action, or we just get onto a new playing field where climate change brings serious changes in our lives. Do you see a consensus developing out there to get going on this, David, or moves that are going to be effective with a consensus or without?
I do think there's growing concern as people look and see visible evidence of change. I think, the most interesting aspect of these new reports, there were three of them on climate change, was that new technologies do allow the reduction of carbon emissions, at a cheaper cost than has been the case before. And so that says people get serious about this, they actually can do something.
The UN panel saying, get busy, and we have the tools to do it, will we? We'll be watching. I want to thank all three of you so much for being with us today. David Ignatius with The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thanks, Tom.
Diane Brady at Bloomberg Businessweek. Always great to have you, Diane.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, thank you so much for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, same to you. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.